Right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the London School of Economics. My name is Ricky Burdett. I'm director of the Cities Program of the LSE. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Alex Garvin to the LSE. You're a guest not only of this institution, but also of the Royal Academy of Arts, which is sponsoring the series of lectures effectively on the city and public space in the city. Alex Garvin is an extraordinary man, even though I've met him only now for 48 hours, who probably, in terms of the aspirations of the city's program, does everything I think we're interested in. He's an intellectual. He's interested in city dynamics. He's interested in power. That's exactly the sort of field of study that at the Cities Program we try and bring together. In other words, we are interested in the work we do at a teaching and research level at understanding the form of the city and understanding the form of social sciences which impact on the city. And it's those two interrelationships which are the sustenance, in a way, of our academic program. And of course, in Ground Zero in New York, these two issues couldn't come closer together, and that's what Alex has very kindly agreed to come and talk to us about. He's in fact called his talk Ground Zero, the battle for the soul of Lower Manhattan, and he will say as much as he can, which is a lot, and we can push him at the end maybe a little bit more, about the battle which is going on for the soul. He will explain very importantly the process of decision making which is happening with the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, of which he's the vice president responsible for design. And it's interesting and sort of turns the heat up that two of the competitors for that, I don't even know whether it's competitors really, but two of the partners in developing ideas for this amazingly important project for New York are in the room with us tonight. I will be joined later by Tony Travers, a colleague of mine at the LSE, who will come up to the platform and engage in conversation with Alex and myself following his lecture. Tony is a student of cities and their transformations and has recently been in New York talking about London, and I think is very well placed to really engage with this discourse. Let me just go back briefly to why I think Alex Garvin is of significance in a way to the wider academic and intellectual debate about cities. He's taught for 30x years at Yale, where he's lectured on the relationships between real estate and city planning, and he's run the most popular course there, which it still is today, on cities. But he's also got his hands dirty in the politics of the city of New York. And I think it may seem a bit odd to try and make that as a sort of unique issue or make a particular point out of it, but in London, I think in particular, or in English municipal development, that translation between sort of intellectual interest and engagement and the practice of politics is really not as sophisticated as it should be. So we are here to learn, Alex, and sort of take notes as to how you do that. He is therefore, in terms of getting his hands dirty, been involved as a planning commissioner of the very important and powerful Planning Commission of the City of New York now for 6 years.
Seven.
Which takes all the sort of key decisions in terms of what happens there, has been involved in housing, and not only is he responsible for the design of Ground Zero and the decision of the process that has been selected, he's also been responsible for the 2012 vision for New York and its bid for the Olympics in 2012. So we have sort of a follower of Robert Moses in many ways in the room today. So for London, we are incredibly pleased to have this. For the LSE and the RA, it's a very good way to start the series. So can you please join me in welcoming Alex Garvin? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ricky. On September 11th of last year, a gang of criminals
damaged the Pentagon, crippled New York City, killed thousands of people, and wiped out billions of dollars of wealth. We are now in New York City demonstrating how those terrorists failed. And what I'm going to talk about this evening is how we are rebuilding, what the interests are that are coming together, how we are rebuilding a 21st century downtown, and what's special about that process. As you look at the destruction, it's important to understand what the site is and is not. In yellow is property owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, plus some other sites as well, such as the site over here, the Deutsche Bank site, a parking lot, a street owned by the City of New York, West Street, which is a state highway that runs through the site, and its immediate surroundings. That is all the area affected immediately by that destruction. Some of those buildings are still empty. Some of them have been reopened. And in coming together, we've had a remarkable situation in New York. People are working together who have never before been willing to cooperate. Mayor Giuliani and Governor Pataki were essentially enemies, as were many governors and mayors of New York. After 9/11, that ended. Mayor Bloomberg is cooperating with the President of the United States and the governor of the state of New York to rebuild New York City. That's an unprecedented event. I remember in the mid-1970s, when New York City had a fiscal crisis, there was a headline in the newspapers, "Ford to New York dropped dead." This time was Bush to New York, $21 billion. That's a big difference. The civic organizations have reappeared in a way that we've never seen them before, and some new ones created. One in particular is playing a major role, a group called New York New Visions. It is a coalition of 21 design organizations in the city of New York that have been offering ideas and helping with the rebuilding of Lower Manhattan. They include the American Institute of Architects, the American Society of Landscape Architects, Graphic Arts, the American Planning Association, organizations that don't usually talk to one another. And that's just the beginning. The World Trade Center site had across the street a property that was leased to the Con Edison Company and the Silverstein Organization, Seven World Trade Center. And what was originally the case was a building which filled a very large site and blocked Greenwich Street going through to the World Trade Center. A group of agencies came together and this May approved a new site plan for Seven World Trade Center. They were the Port Authority, which owned the site, the Con Edison Company, which occupied the first 100 feet or so with an electric power substation, the City Planning Department that was responsible for mapping streets, the city government, including the Corporation Counsel's office, the lawyer for the City of New York, because in order to come out with a different plan that would allow Greenwich Street to go through, you had to give up all this property, which meant that the Silverstein Organization, which leased the property, and Con Edison both had to agree to it. In order to get a large enough site for a substation, that meant that the site had to be expanded southward, which meant the city had to cede a property that was the length of the site and approximately 20 to 25 feet south of it. It meant that the LMDC had to broker the deal along with the Empire State Development Corporation. Now, these are words for you, but for those of us in New York, these are people who are usually at war with one another. I know I had a great deal to do with brokering this deal. The city of New York ceded property in a matter of weeks to the Port Authority of New York. The last mayor, Mayor Giuliani, was in a hot war with the Port Authority. In a hot war with the Port Authority because he believed the Port Authority was cheating New York City of its rightful revenue from airports, which they leased from the city of New York. We are also in the process of restoring the damage. This is a view that I took out of the window of my office approximately 2 weeks ago. Here you see the subway line, the 1 and the 9 subway line in New York. If I had taken this picture when I took my job, there was nothing there. We now have the subway line functioning again. And it's not just that. This is the state highway that I showed you ran through the property. It was reopened last May. There was another subway line that went through the site. It's here in the dark. We just reopened the station that was there at Cortlandt Street. The electric power substation that was on the site of 7 World Trade Center, you can see being replaced right here. That's the deal that I was talking about. An office building of 1.6 million square feet designed by David Childs of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill is going up on top of it for the Silverstein Organization. The surrounding buildings have been cleaned up. A new front door to the World Financial Center and its winter garden. The palm trees are back. The buildings are open again. There are some remaining buildings that are still unoccupied and that have work that are necessary, and they may have to come down, like the Deutsche Bank building. But basically, we are rapidly rebuilding, and what you see here in construction is the PATH train line to New Jersey, which will reopen about this time next year. That's a remarkably fast, under-budget bit of reconstruction. In order to understand what's going on, you need to understand who the players are. And for many of you, these are strange names, so I'm going to linger a little bit. First, there are the property owners involved. Everyone forgets, in a market economy, property owners play an important role. The hole that you see in the ground is owned by the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. The highway that I mentioned, West Street, is owned by the State Department of Transportation. The subway that you see here is owned by the Metropolitan Transportation Administration. Those two are state agencies. Across the street at Battery Park City is a state authority that owns the property. It leases the property to the World Financial Center, which is the Brookfield Organization. The Brookfield Organization owns 8 million square feet of office space, including the building that I'm in from which I took the photograph. In addition to that, the Port Authority has leaseholders on their property, 4 of them. The one many of you have heard about is the Silverstein Organization. They have the right to approximately 10 million square feet of office space. In addition, there's the Westfield Company that had the right to 600,000 square feet of retail that was underground. The Marriott Hotel chain had the rights to a hotel. The federal government had the rights to customs house. Then there are the insurance companies that insured all of these properties. They have rights. They're the lenders that had mortgages on these properties. There's the federal government that's given $21 billion and its agencies. There's the state governments that are involved. The Port Authority is a bi-state agency, which means that the governor of New Jersey controls half the board of the Port Authority and the governor of New York the other half. There are the state agencies that I mentioned and others. There are the city government. The mayor of the city of New York and Deputy Mayor Doctoroff, who plays a major role in what's going on, and all the city agencies, including city planning. And then they're the ones that you read about in the newspapers all the time, the victims' families. You don't read about the victims or the survivors or the rescuers because they are not available to the press. The press plays a big role in everything that's going on. You have community boards in New York City. We have 59 community boards. There's one in particular, Community Board 1 in Manhattan, that's responsible for this area. Then there are the residents of the surrounding areas and the other two community boards, 2 and 3, which include Chinatown, Lower East Side, Tribeca, and all of the occupants of converted Class C office space in Lower Manhattan, some 6,000 apartments that are scattered throughout the financial district. Then you have all the businesses, the large white-collar firms, the small white-collar firms, the small retailers and the big retailers, the civic organizations, which are not just New York New Visions, but the Civic Alliance, the Regional Plan Association, the Municipal Arts Society, and a whole number of them. And then there are the people who watch the destruction of the World Trade Center on television, including all of you, or else you wouldn't be here. And then there is the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, of which I am vice president. The LMDC was established by the governor of New York and the mayor of New York in the wake of 9/11. We have the power to condemn property, to override municipal regulations. We have a substantial amount of money out of that $21 billion from the federal government directly to us. It is a board of directors of 16 people, half appointed by the governor, half appointed by the two mayors, and a small staff of about 43 people, my unit of which is 6 people and a secretary. And we're responsible for trying to revitalize all of Lower Manhattan, south of Houston Street, which is about 2 miles north of the World Trade Center. And that means that we have the job of bringing together all of these different players, convening them, trying to broker deals like 7 World Trade Center, listening to the public, responding. And as part of that, we've issued first a set of principles and blueprint. And we held public hearings on that and revised it. By the way, you can look at everything that we do on our website, which is www.renewnyc.com. We revised the principles and blueprint and came out with 6 design concepts for the Port Authority's program last June, July rather. They were on television worldwide on CNN on the day they were announced. They were on our website on the day they were announced, and we had 4,000 hits a second. America Online was clogged. You couldn't get through. And now we are going through a process with 7 innovative designers to come up with alternative schemes because the public told us that those 6 weren't good enough, and we promptly went out to get something better. What is happening in Lower Manhattan is that it will evolve much in the way I believe the American Constitution evolved, out of the realities of the situation and a tug of war among very, very different and quite powerful interests. The difficulty is that all these interested parties have in mind quite different ideas for what should happen to the site, or how to get that to happen. So rebuilding Lower Manhattan as a 21st century downtown, which is the third thing I want to talk about, is a very difficult process involving quite different interests. The first thing I want to say is that starting with the World Trade Center site is backwards. We have done a bad job of revitalizing Lower Manhattan. We tried 3 times and failed 3 times. The first time was when the Chase Manhattan Bank building was built. You can see it here on the skyline in a photograph I took in 1967, not knowing I was going to come to this august group. But that suddenly stuck up on the skyline announcing the revitalization of Lower Manhattan, we were told. It didn't. The next thing that happened was a plan for Lower Manhattan that included building all the way around Manhattan housing, rebuilding and creating a new World Trade Center site here, and what was to become Battery Park City there. The World Trade Center was the first part of this, and the World Trade Center was built, and it did not revitalize Lower Manhattan. It was followed by housing in the Hudson River in the form of Battery Park City. The land that you see Battery Park City occupying is the earth that was taken out for the foundation of the World Trade Center and became landfill in the Hudson River that became the level of the Battery Park City. And Battery Park City failed to revitalize Lower Manhattan. So it's a very difficult thing. So if you start backwards with the World Trade Center site, you end up with irrelevancies. And we've seen two sets of them now. The first set came in fantasies for the site. Because if you don't think about Lower Manhattan, you end up with a fantasy. This is one particular fantasy that, I'm going to show two, not because I think this is better or worse, but it's typical. In this case, the designer has slashed through the hour of the day that the various airplanes crashed and left in on either side of those gashes very tall office buildings that nobody would want to be close to another office building like that. Didn't seem to concern the designer. Here's another fantasy that will never happen. It also has very little to do with the future of Lower Manhattan. The reasons are simple. They ignore the messy stakeholders and their interactions. They ignore the source of funds to pay for this. They ignore the fact that you don't have an entity to implement it. Who's going to build this? And if you don't know who's going to build something, then it doesn't mean anything. If you don't know how it's going to be financed, or that the various stakeholders will agree to it, it's not going to happen. You have the same sort of thing about memorials. And we will hold an international competition for memorials early this coming year. And we've given the designers that we've asked to come up with proposals for the site the question, where should the memorial be? What should the setting of the memorial be? How should people approach it and depart from it? Because if you look at memorials, if you don't pay attention to the context, that's what happens. I went on a tour with other stakeholders to see memorials around the United States. This is Montgomery, Alabama. And what you see here is a civil rights memorial by Maya Lin. It's a perfectly appropriate memorial, except for the setting. You wouldn't know that it was there. And it is certainly not enhanced by its surroundings. You approach on a series of ramps because it must be accessible for the disabled. The approach doesn't do anything here. Here's another memorial. Here the setting is very clear. And the approach and departure are very clear. The Statue of Liberty, I cannot think of a better sited monument or one that recalls better what's been going on ever since it was built and before, the immigrants that make New York the world's second home. This is Oklahoma City, where another terrorist act was perpetrated. And if you look at this setting, it also is not enhanced by its setting. But the approach is quite significant here. And in fact, it is a whole block with two portals, one on one side and one on the other. This one says 901, and the other one says 903. It's during that time that the memorial that the building was demolished by a bomb. And the memorial itself, the approach is quite dramatic. As for the memorial itself, that's up to you. But going to these memorials convinced me that the problem was, how do you make a memorial that accommodates the program of the Port Authority and becomes a part of the life of the city is a major, major question. And so just designing the memorial doesn't mean anything if you don't think of the city as a whole. And I thought I would show you my favorite memorial, which is in celebration of the liberation of Italy through the Battle of Magenta in 1859. Most of you will recognize it. It's the Galleria in Milan. We've forgotten that that memorializes something, but it has become part of the city. And it accommodates a variety of land uses as well. How do you make Lower Manhattan a 21st century downtown? That is our dilemma. And in the answer to that will come the solution to the World Trade Center site. The first thing is that we have to invest in the public realm, because that becomes the armature around which the private market builds. If there is one thing that I can achieve in my current job, it's this: connecting Lower Manhattan to the international airports and the world. A one-seat ride to the airports is simply more important than anything else. And if we can find a way of doing that and paying for it, we will transform Lower Manhattan from the third largest agglomeration of office space in the United States, after Midtown Manhattan and the Loop in Chicago, into a 21st century downtown like London or Paris that are connected to their airports by mass transit. And the place that you arrive has to be a grand place of arrival. Scuttling in, as Vincent Scully says about the current Pennsylvania station, on your belly like a rat is not satisfactory. It's got to be a great place of arrival when you come there. In addition to that, when you get out of the station, there has to be something there. And here, I think it's very important to look at all of Manhattan, not just the World Trade Center site. It's surrounded by water, 270 degrees around. And there's no place there. If I asked you to characterize Lower Manhattan as opposed to Midtown, you can't. Except maybe you'll mention Broadway. The grid in the rest of Manhattan makes it very understandable, and right away, you know 5th Avenue, you know 42nd Street, you know what is Midtown Manhattan. We have a scheme for Lower Manhattan that will evolve over time, that has grown out of the work of the LMDC and the city government, and it involves creating a 21st century downtown that's understandable and consists not only of a waterfront that goes around 270 degrees, but a loop and a spine. And the loop begins here on that highway. That highway is West Street. It's 260 feet wide. That is 20 feet wider than the Champs-Élysées. There is no reason why it shouldn't be a grand promenade. And if you loop around through Battery Park up Water Street, where the rest of the Class A office space is in Lower Manhattan, that is not at the World Financial Center and a few buildings near the World Trade Center site, it's all here. And this too should be a major street, not just the kind of avenue I'll show you in a minute. And connecting them up, going east-west, is Fulton Street, which could go from river to river, connecting a ferry with a ferry. And let me show you what I mean. This is what West Street looks like today. That's not a major street. It's a barrier separating Battery Park City from the rest of Lower Manhattan. And tying Battery Park City into the rest of Lower Manhattan is central to the loop. Coming around, this is Water Street. It's about 100 feet wide. It has first-class office space, and it's no place. And turning that into something is a major problem. This is much simpler and much less expensive. A few trees and a widened sidewalk and some traffic improvements, some street furniture does the job here. This is Fulton Street. 300,000 people work in Lower Manhattan. It's under-retailed. There isn't even a department store there. There are hardly any good restaurants in Lower Manhattan. Maybe four, maybe five. Think of Chicago. Think of Midtown. Think of any great city and ask yourself, should this be the main retail street going east-west? The only street that anybody can identify is the spine, Broadway. That's the spine. Is that a great street? It's the Canyon of Heroes. It's where the ticker tape parades are held, whether it's for Lindbergh or the winner of the Baseball World Series. But a grand street, it is not. And transforming the loop and the spine is part of turning Lower Manhattan into a 21st century downtown. And so is dealing with the waterfront. As I said before, it's 270 degrees of extraordinary waterfront, inaccessible to the public on the East River. If you go to the East River, which is the side that you're looking here, that's what you look at. An elevated highway and an excuse for access to the water. And yet, if you think of Lower Manhattan, it is an extraordinary thing because every single subway line is contained going north-south in a band that's less than half a mile across. So you can connect on foot and get anywhere you want on the New York City subway system within less than a five-minute walk along Fulton Street, which is why Fulton Street becomes so important to the future of Lower Manhattan. The other thing that's true about a 21st century downtown is it doesn't die at 6 o'clock on Friday and reopen at 9 o'clock on Monday. In city after city, we are seeing the creation of residential mixed-use neighborhoods that support lively retail and other kinds of uses, recreation and cultural facilities that are open on Saturday and Sunday and at night. And when I say cultural facilities, I mean jazz clubs and art studios and dance rehearsal halls, not just museums. We have two such developing areas in New York. One is on a corridor going east of Broadway along John and Fulton Street. And if you look carefully, you'll see the ads for the converted Class B and C office buildings in Lower Manhattan. In this area, east of Broadway, there are now 5,600 apartments, 1,600 in a redevelopment project that was completed in the late 60s, and 4,000 in converted loft and office buildings. That's the beginnings of a neighborhood, but not yet a neighborhood. This is the other one. This is the entrance to the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. It is an obstacle to the revitalization of the area, but if you look at the tall buildings surrounding it, those too have been converted. We have 2,000 apartments south of Liberty Street, south of the World Trade Center site, west of Broadway. And that too could be a mixed-use neighborhood. So if you create a public realm of the loop and the spine and the waterfront and two mixed-use neighborhoods, you have a context into which the World Trade Center site can fit. Last July, we issued six concept plans. Everybody has heard, because the press repeats constantly, discredited plans. And yes, they were not good enough. But there were some things about those plans that the public approved of, and it's important to understand what they were, because they were embodied in the instructions we gave to the designers that are now working on the site and coming up with, I promise you, some wonderful and extraordinary plans, one more different from the next. The first is the public said they want their skyline back. It's not an accident. Some of those schemes actually put the skyline back. I'm not saying that those particular tall buildings are well designed. They're symbolic, that's all. But it does put the skyline back. And every single one of the seven designers going forward are doing this in their own way, and some of them in very dramatic ways, I assure you. Secondly, there has to be a suitable memorial on the site. Everybody told us that. And respect for the footprints. And the scheme that had the skyline also had a grand promenade down West Street. And everybody said that was the right thing to do. But respecting the footprints was not good enough in this scheme that had those two little squares. Those were poetic recollections. Those were not where the two towers actually stood. And that wasn't good enough, apparently. And so they said, we want not just respect for the footprints, we want a variety of open spaces, and we want that promenade. And we want a street grid back, which two of the schemes did, this one included. Not necessarily this street grid, not necessarily the street grid that was there before the World Trade Center, but we want you to reconnect Tribeca, just north, a very popular neighborhood, with this area where the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel is that I showed you a moment ago, where there is a developing new neighborhood. We want you to reconnect Battery Park City with the rest of Lower Manhattan, and we want the financial district to be part of it. And we want a sequence of open spaces that people will be interested in going to. They also told us the Prosaic was unacceptable, and that what we showed in July was unacceptable. And as you think about these things, what they are saying is that design plays an important role in the future of Lower Manhattan, because the public was saying to us, design matters. We already knew this, but it's wonderful when it is said unequivocally and in public. And I thought I'd show you an example of where design already has made a difference. This is the construction fence around the World Trade Center site. It has just gone up. Nobody has ever seen a construction fence like this. And I thought I'd tell you the story of how it happened. As I said, there was a group that had formed after 9/11 called New York New Visions. It included some of the major landscape architects and architects and planners in New York City. I started meeting with them every other week when I took my job. One day, the New York Times reported that there was going to be a 40-foot high wooden fence all around the construction site that had been generally agreed to. I happened to have had an appointment, and I still remember the day because it was the six-month anniversary. We were dedicating the temporary memorial of the globe that had been at the World Trade Center site in Battery Park City, and the executive director of the Port Authority, Joe Seymour, had an appointment to see me. And they were talking about this wall. I said, well, why is it 40 feet high? And he said, well, the people at the World Financial Center don't want to look at the site of this terrorist act. And I said, well, but they're higher up than 40 feet. Why are you spending money on a tall fence like that? Oh, what a good idea. We could save some money, he said. I said, well, how are you going to, why is it this opaque thing? Everybody wants to see the site. It's quite the opposite. There are tourists who are coming in droves here, and you're going to wall it off? Well, what could we do, he said. I said, well, let me think about it. The next day, I met with New York New Visions, and I asked them for their help And they said, well, we'd be happy to do anything. I said, well, the Port Authority says they have to build the fence right away. This was March. We were told the fence had to be up in May. This photograph was taken the first week of November. It's about 2 weeks old. The fence is just going up now. But I didn't know that. And I said, well, would you be willing to come up with some ideas for the fence? And they said, yes. I said, well, Port Authority needs it right away. And they said, all right, on Saturday, can you get us the specifications and a site plan, and we'll put together a group of people to work on it. The group of people, by the way, included some major designers, Diana Balmore, the landscape architect, Hugh Hardy, the architect. These were not insignificant people. And my colleague, Andrew Winters, met them at 9 o'clock in the morning. I came by at 4 o'clock. They had come up with the idea for the fence. And we presented it to the Port Authority the next week. And the Port Authority said, yes, we'll do this, or something like it. And that's pretty well what went up, including various panels which talk about the history of the site, what's going on, identify the names of people who were involved with the site. And you can walk along now, and there's room not only for people on the sidewalk, but also for people to stand in different alcoves and look at the site, read about it, and we have thousands of tourists coming by. And that's an example of what a difference design can make and why the prosaic is not acceptable to anybody. Well, we came out with the 6 concept plans, and the same thing happened. People said it wasn't good enough, and we said, all right, we'll get some new designers in. And I went to New York New Visions, and I said, help us. And they actually wrote the text of the request for qualifications that was responded to by more than 400 design teams from every continent except Antarctica. And we were surprised. We expected maybe 75, maybe 80 responses. There were over 400. I went back to New York New Visions, help us, please. And they said, well, you need a panel to screen this. And we don't want to have anything to do with it, and you shouldn't either. And they have to represent different professions that are involved with the replanning of Lower Manhattan. And so we got a team of 6 people. They were Terry Riley, the curator of architecture of the Museum of Modern Art in New York, Jeannie Birch, the former member of the Planning Commission and currently the chair of the Department of City Planning at the University of Pennsylvania, Toshiko Mori, an architect who lives in Tribeca, just north of the site, but is also the chair of the architecture department at Harvard, Kinshasa Conwell, who had started the Studio Museum of Harlem and was a major institutional design expert, Michael Van Valkenburg, a landscape architect, and Richard Sweat, former ambassador to Denmark, who's the only member of Congress in the 20th century, who was an architect. And they went through for 3 days in our office the various submissions and finally picked for us 6 players whom we added to Peterson and Littenberg, whose work you just saw. And we came out with 6 additional people to work with us, 2 of whom are in the audience, and they represent teams of people, Norman Foster, Daniel Libeskind, a team with Raphael Vignoli, David Rockwell, and Fred Schwartz, a team of avant-garde artists with Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, a team called United Architects with Jesse Reiser and Greg Lynn, younger architects with less of a well-known reputation, and a team of 4 very well-known architects in New York, Richard Meyer, Peter Eisenman, Charles Guathmey, and Stephen Hull. And they have been at work. What you're listening to is something that is unique in the history of planning, design, and development in New York and anywhere else in the world. A different approach to planning, a different approach to participation that I believe will become a new model for this new century we are in. It discards as misguided most 20th century approaches to planning. This is not a set of theories imposed by experts, nor is it a set of dreams that the public has without any means of execution. It's certainly not the least common denominator that avoids opposition from any source. It's not the unconstrained operations of a capitalist real estate venture. Nor is it decision-making by an invisible bureaucracy. It's not a fait accompli by backroom politicians in a smoke-filled room. Nor is it a set of successful projects that ignore the entire district around them. Nor is it one of the two more popular late 20th century schemes, a set of 1, 2, or 3 day charrettes at which architects work with the public to implement whatever ideas are put on the table during those days. It's a tough job. Ask the two people and their colleagues who are in the room, and they will tell you, you don't do this in a day or two. It's not possible. And to suggest that charrettes are the way to carry out planning is crazy. Nor is it what I call the unreal alternatives. We have evolved in the United States something called the Environmental Impact Statement, which every large project like this has to file. And it has a set of alternatives. The left alternative that you're going to reject, the right alternative that you're going to reject, and the correct one in the middle. This is not that either. This is an entirely new process. It's about big ideas. We're not running a design competition. We've asked these designers, give us some big ideas. Believe me, you're going to see in December some big ideas. That's the first stage. And those big ideas integrate the World Trade Center with a memorial and the city of New York. In phase two, we're going to pick a few of them to go forward with and test for feasibility. Yes, the seven, I assure you already, we know work. The question is, are the physical dimensions correct? Do they function properly? Can you get there? What about circulation, freight movement, buses, trains, airport access? What about the cost of this? Can we cover the cost of it? Are the various players willing to put up those costs? What are the sources and uses that they're going to have to compete with for these funds? And what about public acceptance? Our whole approach to public participation and public acceptance is also a new model. You notice I mentioned the website? You can go to our website any day and find out everything that's going on. Every press release, every document we put out, anybody in the world can go and find out about it. That was not possible 15 years ago before the internet. Our publications, we have a few. They're possible because we now have electronic imaging. And then there are public hearings and this town meeting. After we issued the six concept plans, we held a meeting at the Javits Convention Center in New York on a Saturday. You are looking at that meeting. 4,500 people at 500 tables with computer terminals and a facilitator discussing urban design, telling us the designs aren't good enough. When in the history of man have you had 4,500 people discussing urban design? Possible? Only because of the computer terminals. And we've had public hearings in New Jersey, in Connecticut, in all five boroughs, in Lower Manhattan. We have held exhibitions for the six initial plans at Federal Hall in Lower Manhattan, We had thousands of people come by and drop comment cards. We are going to exhibit the work of the 7 designers starting in the middle of December at the Winter Garden at the World Financial Center. You'll be able to see them. You'll be able to see them on the website before we make decisions about them. They are going to be public at the same time as the decision makers see them for the first time. It's a model that empowers the general interest, that goes well beyond the special interests of individual stakeholders, beyond the narrow concerns of individual players, that allows decisions to evolve from the tug of war I mentioned, a tug of war among very, very disparate interests dealing with the realities of the situation. And when we are done, we will have restored the heart of the world's second home, triggered the revitalization of Lower Manhattan, reclaimed the waterfront, and proven the resilience and vitality of our way of life. Thank you. We are about to have a discussion, so stick around.
Alex, thank you very much for that talk. And Tony, could I ask you, Tony Travers, to introduce some of the themes which you think might be even of relevance to us in London?
Well, first I'd like to thank you for an excellent panoptic talk. And as Ricky said at the beginning, an extraordinary picture of a very complex geopolitical situation overlaid with the enormous sensitivity of this particular site. But listening to the very real and obvious efforts that are being made by the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation to be open, to be transparent, to do all the right things, I just sort of wonder whether eventually the process will become paralyzed, whether somehow with all these good ideas, and often an enormous array of different expectations, some people wanting very, very different things to what other people want, that in the end, the search for the wonderful and exhilarating, which in the past where it has occurred has so often been rather randomly chosen by powerful individuals just making a decision, that somehow this process will either require somebody at some point to move in and make such a decision, or whether there's a risk the process will make it very difficult to conclude, to make something that keeps this enormous coalition of interests happy, and therefore to come up with something that really is, to use your words, wonderful and exhilarating. The trade-off between this massive, complex decision-making process, therefore, and a small number or one individual finally saying, I've got to take responsibility, carry the can and do it. I mean, can that trade-off really, really happen on this occasion?
Well, this is the 21st century, and the model you're talking about is a 19th and 20th century model at best, if not earlier. I don't think Baron Haussmann is the model that can exist any longer. Napoleon III doesn't exist. We live in a democracy with a market economy, and a decision-making process that doesn't recognize that will fail. What we need is a decision-making process that's quite different. I'm convinced that the public already has made sure that we don't come up with a prosaic. And I think I've demonstrated some of that, and we have 2 designers in the room who can attest to the fact this isn't business as usual.
Yeah, I see it's not business as usual, of course, and it certainly isn't. But in the end, somebody somehow will have to decide. And the question is, who is the individual, or is it your group, the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, coming to a conclusion which is recommended to the governor or to the mayor, who will then have to decide? Because in the end, this will have to be sewn together. Somebody somewhere in the end will decide what comes out of all of this process?
There are four major figures that have to be involved with this. And I'm not saying them in terms of a person.
Right.
That is four individual people. But the main players that will make this decision are the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, the mayor of the city of New York, the governor of the state of New York, and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. And one of the things we've tried to do is to narrow the decision-making process to a small group of representatives of those four entities. And they will make the decision. They've already made this decision to narrow it down to these seven players. And they will eventually narrow it down to those ideas that will go forward. And I don't know whether that's one or more designers. I do know one thing. We are not taking the designs of one individual as a good idea and giving it to another to design. That's not going to happen.
Just pursue this one step further, Ricky. I mean, there'll always be the suspicion, however well-intentioned and however different you're describing this 21st century process, that in the end, these powerful individuals will speak to each other outside the wonderful, consensual, open 20th century process, and in the end will make a decision of a very old-fashioned kind, because in the end, somebody will have to carry the can politically and economically. And as you said at the beginning, there are very powerful interests tied up here. I mean, what could one say to convince this audience or any other that this decision will be different to all other decisions of this kind?
Those people who saw the presentation of the original six concept plans mm-hmm. on CNN Live saw what was the consensus of the governor and the mayor, the Port Authority and the LMDC. And anybody who saw the reaction of the public of the city of New York will tell you they took one look and said, oh no, that's not good enough. And it will happen again if what we produce isn't good enough. But I'm happy to say
it will
there
be,
are
it?
There are choices among those seven that are great. And it will be difficult. It's no longer a matter of not having good choices. It's going to be, okay, now which of these are we going to do? It may well be that the decision will end up being made about, not about the specifics, but about the commuter tax that the mayor wants to impose on the citizens of New Jersey, or the revenue of the Port Authority that goes to regional transportation, the particular likes or dislikes of the deputy mayor of the city of New York. I won't quarrel with that. But I will say that it's very clear that if the decision isn't satisfactory to the public, it's not going to happen, because there'll be a firestorm of opposition, especially once these things are out in the public. They will be compelling enough that you will not be able to get away with anything else, and that makes this a very different process.
Okay. Ricky, do you want to...
There are two questions here. Can we have the microphone, please? Fred Manson.
I'm Fred Manson, and I was a bureaucrat, and so I know all the problems about trying to implement things, and it is an interesting bit to talk about.
Keep it a bit further away from
me. Okay. Is that all right?
Better.
Great. My concern is really following on from Tony's. You can easily get a consensus for people who say no. It's much more difficult to get a consensus for people who are saying yes. And in your last comment, it could be that someone was going to sort out the questions of tax. It could be someone who was going to sort out the questions of revenue.
What? The mic a little further away.
Okay. Can you hear me still?
No. It's much better.
Great. I'll learn to use these things at some stage. Those are introducing really quite extraordinary different levels of points. Whereas you earlier said that, in fact, you were doing this thing from the wrong way round. You were trying to sort out Lower Manhattan, which hadn't been sorted out from the 60s, using the World Trade Center. And I think the further difficulty that I would add to your problems, you're going to select a design for a site. But that design has as its obligation sorting out transport to the two airports, sorting out the taxation system for the city, redefining Lower Manhattan so it's going to beat Chicago into second place as a place where people want to be, redefine a part of the city so it's going to be this new 21st century sense of vitality. And yet, you have to come up with a scheme which is only on 16 acres. You have to come up with a scheme which can be implemented within a very short period of time. And I think what you're going to find out is there's a very, very great risk that you're going to have different people voting for completely different things, and that there'll be perfectly rational conclusions that each person is taking, but they're going to be pointing in different directions.
Okay.
You forgot one of the players, and it's not surprising because that player has been relatively silent for the last 9 months, and that is Mayor Bloomberg. You will be hearing from Mayor Bloomberg in early December what the future of Lower Manhattan is in the mind of the city government. The plan which I described was discussed with all of the designers. They know this plan. They've heard it before. They've been asked to design within that context. The mayor of the city of New York and the city government is necessary to implement the loop, the spine, the waterfront, and all the rest of that. And you will be seeing what the city is going to be doing to carry that out. They also need partners. The MTA is central to all of that, including burying the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel and creating a new neighborhood. And they have been at work together on those things, so that the context is going to move ahead. What we need is the airport connection. That's the big one. And there are ways of doing it that are relatively simple to New Jersey. It's a 2-mile extension on an existing right-of-way that brings you directly to the monorail that goes around New York Airport. There's going to be a fight over whether that's a New Jersey project or a New York project, but that's not a lot of money, and it'll be quick to do, and it's easy. The problem is, what of the many ways of bringing AirTrain from Kennedy Airport directly downtown going to be the way to go forward? There's been an agreement at this point among the various transportation agencies, the LMDC, the governor, and the president, that $4.5 billion of the $21 billion is going to transportation. And some of that money is now earmarked as a down payment for the access to the airport. There's no doubt that the various bureaucracies can subvert all of this. That's easy. And as you say, it's easy to stop things, very difficult to make things happen.
The concern is not the bureaucracies, the democracies. That's what you're hearing here.
No, I think here they have their own agendas. I think the gentleman is quite right what he said. But I would say something else. When you have a big idea like getting directly to Kennedy Airport, there's an amazing way that it has of surviving opposition. It's one of those things that every time I say, everybody looks up and their reaction is, well, of course. The only question is the money. Well, we'll find the money. It's not easy. But that's the one difficult one in this, because we don't have enough money for it.
But I mean, taking the transport hub idea, I mean, the airport linkage is but one of a number of really good ideas for improving the transport. And I mean, the idea of a hub that perhaps brings together an existing group of subway lines into something more comprehensible, or extending the Second Avenue subway down, or bringing the main line down from Grand Central, or whatever it is. There are a whole range of ideas here. And again, somehow a priority will have to be struck, because any one of these will be expensive, but to do all of them, I mean, there's a risk that each one will impede the other. I mean, it's the classic problem we meet in London all the time.
Well, we at the LMDC are publishing a book in a couple of, well, somewhere between 4 and 8 weeks with all the transportation alternatives spelled out. There is now agreement on a few of them. There is an agreement on tying together all of the subway lines that are now connected at Fulton Street. They are, just to give you a sense, and you know about lines in London, but this would bring together in an easy transfer point the
2, the 3, the 4, the 5, the A, the C, the E, the M, the J, and the Z lines. And if you try to change at Fulton and Broadway, anybody here try to make that change ever on the subway in New York? It's a disaster. We have an agreement with the MTA that this is a priority. We have $750 million allocated out of that 4.5 for it. It is going forward. That's and right. That is at the corner of Fulton and Broadway. And I just said the spine and the loop are Fulton and Broadway. So the future of Fulton and Broadway is key to doing that. And that takes out some of the ratty stores that I showed you.
Let's try and get a few more comments in. Savas?
Hi. The question relates specifically to the understanding of the skyline and its relationship with memory. You, three times in your text, you divided that the task of the seven proposals were to come up with solutions for memory and for the skyline. I wonder how separate these really are in your mind, and in view of the symbolism that skylines have normally taken in capitalist societies, the World Trade Center, how worldly was it? What can we think of, in the same way that you showed the slide of the Statue of Liberty, the relationship of a new symbolism for skylines? And this is political symbolism.
It happens that two designers in the room have come up with answers to your question. You will have to wait until the 19th or 20th of December to see them. But I assure you, they have powerful answers.
One of the designers has a comment. Raphael Vignon. Microphone?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Just simply wanted to point out that the to hear the litany of difficulties is probably our trade every morning. We're kind of learn cynicism 101 the minute we launch ourselves in this profession. I have only to say one thing, which is probably summarizing what Alex articulated before, which is that this is a unique process, and it's not a unique process because Alex is a genius or we are innovative designers or anything. It's the magnitude of the situation, it's the level of tabula rasa that has occurred, not only in terms of physical presence, but also economically, financially, emotionally, and otherwise. And I think that when you deal with situations like this, the famous idea of who are the stakeholders and how you actually manage them together and how you set up priorities is out to a new condition, which is undeterminable. To me, the most encouraging and probably the most frightening part of this process is that it is undeterminable. In other words, when Alex tells you that he doesn't know what's going to happen, I think that's frightening if you look at it in a typical architect-patron relationship like you have here. But it is also wonderful because it is really the only truth. We don't know what's going to happen. And it depends, so there is a moving target for which there is a capital of goodwill that nobody knows how long it's going to last, and if it doesn't last too long or long enough, it would be a pity, like many other things. And, but there is an unusual, a completely unusual level of goodwill to consider things that are not in your radar screen as a typical vision of a stakeholder. And that's remarkable in everybody that I have encountered there. And I'm not saying that I don't have massive disagreements with most of them, but that makes me part of the salad somehow. But the truth is that there is one thing which is absolutely evident, which is that nobody's trying to impose a mechanism an intellectual mechanism or a political mechanism or a voting mechanism or a professionalized mechanism, that the mechanism is being discovered. I think that the opportunity that the LMDC opened to all of us to submit for this proposal was shaky at best, but it was also incredibly brave because it was recognizing the fact that a certain route had not worked and they were open to see another thing. So I think that that we have to have an expectant view on this. The more people that can contribute ideas and thoughts about the process, the better it is. I think there is enough intellectual power in New York to process those ideas and those comments. But the truth is that I don't think New York knows how this is going to come out. And if it frightened many people, that's exactly the same feeling that Jefferson had when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And it really worked quite well.
Comment at
I
the
think
back.
You need one, by the way.
Last comment, I think, from the back. You? Yes?
Hi. Very excited to see the proposals. Weren't they going to come out in November? But that's not my question. My question is, obviously, the disaster in New York has created an opportunity. It's created a site and the political will to see a lot of other issues that probably wouldn't have come to a head, looked at and resolved. Do you think that this process is going to create a model for elsewhere in America, thinking specifically of cities like Detroit, where the city center's been almost abandoned, or at LA, where you know there's almost no pedestrian life to the city? And if so, is that something that you know the movement that's come together with this might move on to address?
Yes, I think it is going to be a model, but it's going to be a model for participation. I don't think that there is another project quite like it in physical terms anywhere. Or certainly in symbolic terms. But I do think that it represents a different way of doing a large and important project in a city, quite different from things that have been done previously. And that will be a model.
I think I'd like to wrap up at this point. Obviously, there are more questions and more comments, and perhaps Alex could hang around for another 5 minutes, even though he's been at it for 24 hours, really. I think what is important for those of us who are now quite involved in trying to shape some of the big decisions facing London, which are not dissimilar, actually, connection to transport, connecting transport to development, creating mixed use in and densifying and making people change their perceptions of the process of design. Those of us who are involved in that, the more we're involved, the more we realize that the decisions are taken behind closed doors. And I think that's exactly what Tony, in a way, was getting at. And there's a certain incredulity, very benevolent incredulity, that our brothers on the other side of the ocean can, in a way, get this right. Because, as you've said yourself, there are going to be four key players, one of whom hasn't shown his cards yet, who's not represented in the architectural jury, which is interesting.
Oh, yes, he is.
Okay, fine. Okay, fine. Well, now we're...
In many ways, none the least of which is Deputy Mayor Daniel Doctoroff, who has been one of the people who will be involved in making those decisions.
But we need to, in a way, watch your space very carefully, not just because of the quality of what is going to come out of it, because we wish your city extremely well, as you know. But we're incredibly interested in the process because I think it's touching very much the sort of the centralized, backroom, smoke-filled processes that we know only too well here. And an attempt to do two things, which is open up the process but also maintain the quality of a strong architectural and urban design idea, which we've often seen get lost in a process of over-participation in parts of London. But I think these are the issues which you're facing. We hope we can help. We'll come and visit. We hope that the ideas in the room...
Ricky, yes? And that is that I think this is the first time in New York City in my lifetime that design and a strong idea has played a part in the decision-making process. We've never had that before. And if I'm proud of anything at all, it's of getting that to be part of the process. And it didn't have to be. It almost disappeared.
On the part of the RA, the LSE, Alex Garvin, thank you very much.